Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On the final day of its session, no retirements, but the U.S. Supreme Court did issue major rulings on internet file sharing, restraining orders, and other issues. But two rulings on the Ten Commandments stand out. The justices narrowly ruled that frame displays of the Ten Commandments in two Kentucky courthouses violate the separation of church versus state. But a 6-foot-tall granite monument on the grounds of the Texas State Capitol does not. Well, joining us on the line, two Supreme Court veterans who will explain all of this to us. Lyle Denniston now writes for SCOTUSblog.com. Lyle, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. It's okay.
Good morning again.
We're right in the middle. And Jonathan Turley, he teaches law at George Washington University. Jonathan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Lyle, in the court's eyes, what's the difference between the framed displays that are in the Kentucky courthouses and that 6-foot granite monument that's on the grounds of the Texas State Capitol?
Well, the Kentucky Courthouse monuments were put up originally for what the court determined was a religious purpose, that is, to display the commandments all by themselves, giving them obviously clear statement of their religious character, and that purpose never changed when they switched the display and put it among other historic documents in two different changes while the case was going through the courts. The court said that is clearly done for a religious purpose. In the Texas case, the controlling opinion turns out to be one not written by the Chief Justice, but by Justice Breyer, who joined in the outcome, but wrote an opinion that turns out to be controlling. And he said decisive for him was the fact that the monument in Texas had been there for 40 years, was only recently challenged, and was surrounded by a number of other historic monuments, and so it was not infected by the religious purpose, as was the displays on the courthouse walls in the two Kentucky counties.
And the monument in Texas was also donated by a private group, the Order of the Eagles, which has donated displays to governments all across the country. Did that factor into the decision?
Well, the court found that the donation by the Eagles organization wouldn't make a difference because the Eagles organization is a private group, and what counts is the motivation of the public officials, because they are the ones who are accountable under the Constitution. And so they found that at least in the Texas case, after all this time, it is clear that the monument to the Ten Commandments serves a non-religious purpose along with the other historic monuments out there. And they did not find the same thing in the Kentucky County's case.
And Jonathan Turley, Justice Scalia wrote the dissent. What did he say?
Well, Scalia wrote one of his signature dissents, a scathing indictment of the court. And there is room for criticism. Scalia is basically saying that the court's precedent in this area is unintelligible. And that's probably right, that the regardless of how you come out, this is a perfect mess. I mean, many of us thought when the court accepted two cases that it was going to create a comprehensive treatment of the area and to clarify what has been an extremely ambiguous series of rules in the past. In reality, what we got were two opinions that reflected the court. It was divided, it was ambiguous, and it remains uncertain. The only thing you get out of here is sort of the rule from real estate, location, location, location. You know, that it depends on the context, where this thing is, what the motivation might be. But these opinions continue a legacy of near confusion in this area.
Well, we're going to get reaction in a second, and we might hear just that. But Scalia also wrote further that even though the government officials in Texas may have had a religious purpose when they originally posted those Ten Commandments, they had also tried to dilute that religious message by hanging other historical documents in the courthouse as well. So does he make a point there or no?
Well, in Kentucky, there was this effort to dilute. You know, the Kentucky case probably rubbed some of the justices the wrong way, because It was clearly an effort to sort of beard the lion. You know, the Kentucky case was a more recent addition to these courthouses, both of these different displays. And it was an obvious effort to try to create a challenge. And as they began to hit rough weather, they started to graft on other documents to make it a better case for appeal. That type of manufactured case obviously did not sit well with the court.
Well, we want to get some quick response to some of the other rulings. We'll tick through them. And Lyle, the justices issued two big rulings on the Internet, one siding with the entertainment industry on file sharing, saying that file sharing software companies can be held liable if they encourage customers to illegally download music and movies. Keyword there, Lyle, seems to be encouraged. Does that just mean they can't promote it?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that when you analyze this case very closely, it means that these two particular software designers, Grokster and Streamcast Networks, went over the line because not only did they create the software that people can use, the free software for downloading music and movie files, but they actively suggested that this is the way that you can get free music and movies, and promoted it actively. And much of Justice Souter's opinion dwells upon the particular marketing strategies that these two software companies use in order to try to induce computer users to download files and then to share them among others freely. So I think it's a fairly narrow decision in terms of imposing liability. Unfortunately for file swappers, it imposes a potential liability or actual liability on the two companies that are now the dominant producers of file sharing software. So,
yeah, and I just want to get to Jonathan. With the justices also rejected appeals from journalists Matt Cooper and Judith Miller of the New York Times, who refused to testify before a grand jury about the leak of undercover CIA officer Valerie Plame's identity. So briefly, Jonathan, where do these two journalists go now?
Well, they could go to jail. The court has not been particularly protective over journalistic privilege or privileges in other areas. And this is a case that cries out for federal legislation to protect journalists. You know, journalists cannot do their job and serve what is a great public interest with this Damocles sword dangling over their heads. And the Supreme Court said, we're just not going to help you.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Lyle Denniston writes for SCOTUSblog.com. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Well, as we heard, the Supreme Court delivered a mixed decision on displaying the Ten Commandments on government property. The court, again, said no to displays of the Ten Commandments in two Kentucky courtrooms, saying the original intent of the displays was religious. But the 6-foot granite display in the middle of war memorials outside a Texas courthouse can stand because it is part of an historical display. Well, joining us on the line now, Dr. Barry McCormick, a director of the Christian Coalition of America. Welcome.
Good to be with you today.
And Rob Boston, he represents Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Rob, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me on.
And let's start with you, Dr. McCormick, your reaction to the court's rulings.
Well, I'm reminded of an old expression of a white man speaks with a forked tongue. We've got two decisions, but the main theme here is that we are incrementally stamping out all vestiges of our Christian heritage. This is the main deal.
So you feel this was a negative ruling for your group and your feelings about the Ten Commandments?
Yes, I think that the Texas decision, of course, is rather positive, but the overall angle of this whole thing will be to take all Christian witnesses out of the public square.
Well, but do you understand that this is the purpose of the court was to draw the line between church and state?
Yes, but I have a very difficult time with the fact that there is a separation of church and state as it is now being put forth. This whole thing has been turned on its head by secular fundamentalists.
Well, Rob Boston, your organization promotes the separation of church and state. How did you react to the rulings?
Well, on balance, I think these rulings are pretty good. The court, even in the Texas case, declared that a Ten Commandments display has to have a historical reason behind it, not a religious reason. So they're allowing the Ten Commandments to be displayed in a historical context when it's part of a larger display of other elements. But they're saying if a community has religious intent behind its display, that has to go. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. It's not the job of the government at any level to promote religion. That's the job of our churches and synagogues and temples and mosques.
Would you be accepting of a Ten Commandments plaque, let's say, in a courtroom, as long as there was some other plaque depicting some other kind of history on it? Because that's what the court seems to be saying.
The court is definitely saying context matters, and I think what we're going to have to do is look at these displays one by one and see if they hold up. I've been in the chambers of the U.S. Supreme Court many times. They have a frieze on the wall. One of the images on that frieze is Moses cradling the Ten Commandments, but they also have Hammurabi up there. They have Roman emperors up there. They have Greek lawgivers up there. Obviously, the intent of that display is to educate about the evolution of the law over many centuries. I think that's okay, but I think for a community to take the Ten Commandments and say, we're going to have a display on our Christian heritage, which is what they did in Kentucky, and we're only going to put religious documents up here, obviously they've stepped over the church state line at that point.
That's Rob Boston. He represents Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's obviously happy with today's Supreme Court rulings. Dr. Barry McCormick with the Christian Coalition of America is not. But Dr. McCormick, the court seems to be saying that as long as you put the Ten Commandments next to some other historical plaque, it's okay. Isn't that, in a way, a win for your organization?
No, indeed, because it is declaring it is more and more irrelevant, and it's situated on the periphery of the public square. It's a long way from the time when the Supreme Court said that America is a Christian nation. They declared it, you see. And we're gradually, bit by bit, eroding all of that earlier historical decision.
What do you see happening now? Is there anything that your group plans to do?
Well, I think that we will be more careful now to try and make sure that we get judges on the bench who have an appreciation of the Constitution as it was written, and not for a living constitution that can be changed at the whim of secular humanists.
Scalia wrote a dissent to the decision. He argued that the Ten Commandments displays are a legitimate tribute to the nation's religious and legal history. I would assume you agree with him.
Yes, absolutely.
Rob, last word and a reaction to that.
Well, obviously, we aren't trying to remove religion from the public square. People are free to celebrate that in many ways. All we're saying is that the government really shouldn't be in the business of promoting religion, advocating for it, funding for it, or forcing it onto anybody. Religion has to be freely chosen by individuals to be meaningful, and to have the state sort of press anything on you, I think it's inappropriate. And also, too, I would point out these claims that the Ten Commandments are somehow the basis of our legal system, as Scalia seems to imply. It's nonsense. Most of them are not reflected in our legal system. You're free to worship no god, one god, 15 gods, 20 gods. You're free to make idols. Many numbers of the Ten Commandments, you know, are not reflected in our secular legal system. So I think not only does it violate the separation of church and state, but it sends a wrong message to people to pretend that this religious moral code somehow is the foundation of our legal system. It's not.
Rob Boston represents Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Dr. Barry McCormick is the director of the Christian Coalition of America, both reacting to today's Supreme Court rulings on the display of the Ten Commandments. Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there were no resignations from the court today, but if and when one comes from Chief Justice William Rehnquist, what will his legacy be? That's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on this last day of the Supreme Court's session, speculation continues to swirl about a possible resignation of at least one of the court's justices. Chief Justice William Rehnquist has served on the court for 33 years, 19 of those as Chief Justice. He's also suffering from thyroid cancer, which sidelined him briefly last year and forced him to work part of the session from home. If and when the Chief Justice steps down, he will leave the nation's legal landscape far different than he found it. Indiana University Law Professor Craig Bradley is a former Rehnquist clerk and the editor of a forthcoming collection of essays that considers the legacy of the Chief Justice. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Let me ask you, first of all, is it possible to sum up the legacy of one of the longest-serving Chief Justices of the Supreme Court in just a sentence or two?
Well, I think you can say that Rehnquist has been one of the most consistent voices for conservatism over his 33-year tenure on the court, constantly pushing to move the court in a more conservative direction.
As I understand it, Rehnquist set two goals for himself as Chief Justice. Tell us about those.
Well, I suspect he had many more than that. The only two that he's mentioned is to be known as a good administrator, which he certainly has been. Everybody seems to agree that he's run the court extremely effectively. And then the other one, which he cited more as an accomplishment than a goal, was to cut back on the sweeping rulings of the Warren Court involving the rights of criminal defendants. And in both of those, he's certainly been successful.
How has he changed what the Warren Court did?
Well, you can't really answer that question with regard to Rehnquist personally, because it takes a majority always to do anything. But the Republicans have been in the majority of the court the entire time that he's been on it, which is incredible that you would have your own party be in the majority the whole time that long. But the court has significantly cut back on the rights of criminal defendants, for example, establishing a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule in Fourth Amendment cases. So if the police get a warrant, even if it turns out that that warrant was bad, the fact that they believed in good faith that when the magistrate signed it that they had probable cause, the evidence will be admitted. Now, Rehnquist himself didn't write that opinion, but he was part of it.
Tell us about his ability or not to influence other members of the court when they're deciding on cases.
Very, very limited. He's got a very well-qualified, very tough-minded court. And also, he never really made any effort to do that on a personal level, to go around from chamber to chamber and try to talk somebody into something. I think that he thought it was unseemly. You write your opinions, and you try to convince by the force of your written argument.
And because of that, I would imagine, at least partially because of that, he's been on the losing side of some decisions on some tough issues. And is that unusual for a Chief Justice?
No, not at all. The notion that the Chief Justice somehow leads the court in any meaningful sense is simply wrong. I mean, Earl Warren seemed to lead the court simply because he had a majority of justices willing to go along with him. Rehnquist frequently doesn't on key cases, as you've noted. I don't think it's Rehnquist's fault. They're just tough-minded, thoughtful members of the court who don't agree with him.
But while they didn't necessarily agree with him, they apparently had great respect for him. Justice Thurgood Marshall talked about him as a great Chief Justice. And in this piece that you wrote, you note that Justice William Brennan described Rehnquist as the most all-around successful chief he'd ever known.
Right. The emphasis is on the word chief here. In other words, as is well known, those two justices disagreed with him bitterly on almost every case. What they were saying was that he's a very good administrator as Chief Justice, that he runs the conference and the courtroom smoothly. And nobody disputes that. Every justice who has spoken on the issue agrees that Rehnquist is a superb administrator. But Brennan and Marshall were not saying that he's a superb legal theorist or that he wrote wonderful opinions or anything like that. You only have to read their dissents to see that.
Well, you note in your piece that they generally condemn his legal positions, as sometimes calling them misguided or even dangerous.
Right. Those are statements from criminal procedure cases where Brennan and Marshall, who were holdovers from the Warren Court, bitterly resisted the attempts, usually successful by Rehnquist and others in the Republican majority, to limit the rights of criminal defendants that had been established by the Warren Court.
I found it interesting in reading your piece to learn that the Rehnquist Court has struck down more legislation than previous courts. Why is that?
Well, they're a very activist court. For one reason or another, majorities seem to collect to strike down legislation. Often Rehnquist is in dissent. So it's not as if this is some program of Rehnquist personally. The whole court, I think, has to be described as activist.
Which is interesting, given that much of the debate about nominating new people to federal judgeships preceding the possible nomination of a new Supreme Court justice revolves around judicial activism and conservatives decrying the fact that there are too many activist judges on the bench.
Conservatives, particularly Scalia and Thomas, more so than Rehnquist, are perfectly prepared to be activist themselves when it suits them. But it depends on what you mean by activist to some extent. Rehnquist was an activist in the sense that he thought that the court had gone too far in issues like abortion, for example. He thought that they were making things up and putting them in the Constitution. he himself does not do that very much. In other words, he doesn't interpret the Constitution broadly. He thinks it should be interpreted narrowly and more closely to its text. So his form of activism is a little different from the so-called liberal activists that the Congress is decrying.
Professor Bradley, let me ask you this. What kind of lasting impact has William Rehnquist had?
Well, it's impossible to assess someone's lasting impact while they're still on the bench. We're not even sure that he's going to retire. So history will have to answer that, but certainly in the 33 years he's been on the court, the law has moved in a more conservative, more rights-restrictive direction than it was when he joined the court.
Professor Craig Bradley, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay, sure.
Craig Bradley is a law professor at Indiana University Law School. He's also a former clerk for Chief Justice Rehnquist and the editor of a forthcoming book called The Rehnquist Legacy. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, President Bush will speak to the nation about the situation in Iraq. We'll take a closer look at the topic he's sure to address, Iraq's rising insurgency. Also, an average mother with cancer who feels that marijuana saved her life. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A generation of children born with HIV and AIDS is beginning to come of age, and their parents are now faced with an astounding dilemma. How do I tell my child that he or she is HIV positive? When the children were born, it was thought their lives would be short ones, so many parents never disclosed the illness to the children or even to family and friends. But with medical advances, the children are living much longer, and parents are realizing they can no longer keep their carefully guarded family secret. Jonathan Dee wrote about adolescents with HIV and AIDS in this weekend's Sunday Times Magazine. He joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined by Dr. Claude Mellins, co-founder of the Special Needs Clinic at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Mellins.
Hi, Robin.
And Jonathan, first to you, this seems inconceivable because we know that people with HIV or AIDS have to take daily life-saving medication. So how is it that these children can reach, 11, 12 years old and not know that they have HIV?
Well, as they grow older, certainly they start to ask questions, but at the beginning, most of those questions are rather easily addressed. When the kids are small, the mother may just say, because you have to take your medicine in order to stay healthy, or it may be couched in some way like you have a disease that has to do with your blood, and you have to take it in order to keep that disease at bay. Often the mother herself or others in the family are taking the same drugs, so they take them at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the denial that that goes on in the household about that, in terms of it being a taboo subject to discuss, is something that a small child absorbs almost instinctively.
Right. And so the parents are keeping sometimes the children's secret and their own.
Oh, yes. That's a big part of the secrecy surrounding the whole issue, is that it's not just a secret involving the child, but it's a family secret.
I think the other thing that's important to also know is that just because the child hasn't been officially told their diagnosis doesn't mean that they don't always know. And sometimes kids have actually known for a long time, but they've learned to maintain the secret.
And the fear. And Dr. Mellins, what do parents tell you about keeping the secret? And explain to us what position it puts a doctor in, because you're not allowed to tell.
Well, I think that parents have to balance a lot. And as the parent of three children myself, I can really understand many of these. They have to think about what's the child's capacity to understand what the illness is. They have to think about the child's rights and their questions that they may ask, the family's right to privacy. This is a disease with a lot of stigma, so they're often very afraid that the child will tell people and then there will be social ostracism. And then they just have to think about their own and the child's emotional readiness, as well as any secrets that may get revealed in the process. Most importantly, I think any parent doesn't want to upset their child.
And by law, as a doctor, you're not allowed to tell the child.
Correct. So I think what happens is as children get older, and most parents, I think, actually do try to tell sometime between 6 and 10, but there are definitely, as Jonathan wrote in the article, a group that don't. And I think as children approach older childhood and early adolescence, doctors really work hard with them to help them get to a point where they feel comfortable telling their children and support them in that process.
Right. Part of the reason this is such an issue is there have been dramatic improvements in treatment for HIV and AIDS. And medical advances leading to a dramatic decline in the number of babies born with HIV/AIDS. Can you remind us about that?
Yes, one is clearly mothers taking antiretroviral treatment during pregnancy, and that led to the biggest reduction. But then also the recommendation that mothers not breastfeed when they have other alternatives to feed their children, because a lot of transmission actually happens after birth.
One of our first thoughts reading the article was safety. HIV is a bloodborne virus. Kids fall down, they cut themselves, they bleed. What do parents say about that aspect of it, that, you know, nobody knows that these children are sick?
Most of the parents that I spoke to were very vigilant about letting, for instance, people at school know, sometimes to the child's apparel, but still, they were concerned about the safety of others and were quite good about letting people know in order to avoid situations like that.
But you also cited an instance where a parent was told by an agency, listen, everybody should know that you should use gloves.
That's true. There was a branch of ACT UP in the 90s that took a rather hardline approach to this and basically said that everyone on Earth now is responsible for his or her own safety in terms of HIV. The mother that I spoke to about this particular issue, though she was an ACT UP member herself, she wound up disagreeing with that position.
Boy, Dr. Mellon, as you've said, it's such a tough situation that nobody has a handbook for. How are parents telling kids, and what are some of the repercussions?
I think there are several ways, and it depends on the age of the child. For young children, and actually even as they age a little bit, parents often begin by talking to them about having something wrong with their blood or having a blood illness without giving it a name. And for young children, that's okay, because the name by itself may not mean anything. And as they get older, they often will either just tell them directly or with the help of a book. There are a few books out for children learning their diagnosis, or they may ask medical providers to help them do it.
Yeah, and Jonathan, as you write, there's sometimes strange repercussions. I mean, you write about an 8-year-old who was so excited about this new news that she went in and told everybody at school, and that didn't go so well.
It didn't go so well for her, no. I'm so impressed by what goes on within the sort of bubble of these treatment facilities between the parents and the doctors and all that. But even if it goes perfectly there, there's still the outside world to contend with, a lot of fear and a lot of prejudice. It's particularly tough for a small child to encounter.
No, I think that our biggest wish is that the stigma would go away and that there wouldn't be any of it. But there is still tremendous stigma everywhere, even in adults. And so I think children have to tread very cautiously. The teenagers in our clinic have experienced rejection when they've talked to partners, and it is very hard. I think we've come far, but there is still a long way to go.
Have there been teenagers who have been able to have relationships?
We have definitely have teenagers who've been able to have relationships, and we have teenagers who've been successful at letting partners know and using contraception to prevent transmission. We've also had the reverse.
I would just jump in there and say that many of the young people I talk to, each of them seem to have maybe one bad story, but many more good and impressive stories about the way their close friends, the way their romantic interests reacted when this issue came up. And it does give you the sense that while the prejudice certainly hasn't gone away, it's a very different world than it was 20 years ago. But I think in that respect, it's no different for these young people than for HIV-negative young people. You know, the precautions are the same.
Right. By the way, Jonathan, you also write that one of the reactions of these preteens is that they are almost overachievers. They want to accomplish so much in their lives because they don't think they're going to live long lives, even though they've lived longer than anyone thought.
Their prognosis at this point, as I understand it, is open-ended. But it's very true, as you say, that for people who are, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, astonishingly driven and organized and impressive and mature, they carry into adulthood a sense of responsibility about the time that they've been given.
Jonathan Dee is a novelist, and he authored the article, Their Unexpected Adolescence. It appeared in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Dr. Claude Mellons is co-founder of the Special Needs Clinic at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and she interacts with many of the young people Jonathan wrote about. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, after producing recording stars such as Sean Colvin and Keith Richards, Kenny White moves to the microphone. You're listening to Here and Now. When it comes to treating lung cancer, the leading cause of cancer-related death, bucking the conventional wisdom can prolong some patients' lives for 2 years on average. A study published in the most recent New England Journal of Medicine says that adding chemotherapy after surgery to remove cancerous lung tumors increases the patient's average lifespan from 6 to 8 years. Here in Oz, Deborah Becker spoke with Texas oncologist Catherine Pisters, who wrote the editorial that accompanies the New England Journal of Medicine report. Pisters says she's astonished by the study's results.
For years, we've hoped that we would find results like this. For many years, we studied giving chemotherapy after surgery to lung cancer patients, and our early attempts, unfortunately, didn't give us promising results.
Why is that?
Well, probably because those individual studies were relatively small, and the drugs we used were the best drugs that we had available at that time, but unfortunately probably just weren't active enough. This study, which was published in the New England Journal, is the first study that is very clearly positive. It showed a 15% improvement in the 5-year survival rate, or an improvement, a relative improvement of 30%, a 30% reduction in your risk of death. And so when I speak to my patients and say, gee, if we give you chemotherapy, we can lower your risk of death from lung cancer by 30%. They're all very eager to take treatment now.
What about patients who may have had surgery a year or so ago or even longer?
We don't know whether giving chemotherapy a year or more later is still beneficial, and that would be something that patients should discuss with their physicians.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, what are the side effects from this type of chemotherapy that was used in the study?
Well, they'd be fairly typical for what I think most folks think of with chemotherapy: lowering of the blood counts, hair loss, fatigue, and nausea and vomiting. But now we have medicines that can really help with many of those side effects. So I think the majority of patients really tolerated the treatments quite well.
Mm-hmm. And what are these new chemotherapy drugs? Are they used for other cancers right now?
They are used for other cancers. One of the drugs that was used in the New England Journal study is a drug called cisplatin, which has been around for many, many years and is actually considered to be kind of the backbone of therapy for the treatment of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. The other drug that was given in the study was a drug called vinorelbine or navalbine. Again, a drug that's been around for a while, but is probably a slight improvement on its predecessors.
I'm wondering, I think this sort of begs the question, and I hope it's not too cynical, but do you think that there's a different type of treatment for lung cancer, almost because there may be a belief, really, that folks are almost to blame for having this type of cancer?
Well, that's one of the biggest things that we struggle against. You know, everybody has a habit that they shouldn't do. Nobody is perfect. And for many years, lung cancer has suffered the stigma of tobacco use. I do think that, unfortunately, lung cancer research has been very underfunded compared to other common solid tumors such as breast cancer or prostate cancer, and we're really trying to get away from that. You know, the nicest people in the world get lung cancer, and certainly nobody deserves it.
And what do the statistics show? It's 9 out of 10 lung cancer cases can be attributed to smoking usually?
That's correct. Okay. But many of the cases that are now diagnosed are diagnosed in former smokers. I'm certainly encouraging people to stop smoking, but unfortunately your risk for developing lung cancer never goes back to a never smoker's risk.
Mm-hmm. So is more study needed, would you say, or is this sort of a recommendation to doctors that this has
to be? This is clearly a recommendation. This is clearly a change in the standard of care. For patients who have had a complete removal of their lung tumor and they've done well after their surgery, this is clearly a change in the standard of care for patients with lung cancer.
Dr. Catherine Pisters is an oncologist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Her article on treating lung cancer appears in the most recent edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. She spoke with Here and Now's Deb Becker. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Some great music ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Too often, the record producer of a critically acclaimed CD gets too little recognition. Take Kenny White. He's worked with Mark Cohn, Sean Colvin, Keith Richards, and Peter Wolf. We asked Peter, former lead singer of the J. Geils Band, how he teamed up with Kenny.
Someone recommended Kenny, and I knew some of the work he had done. And we got together one day in a studio, and I was playing him some of my songs, and he sat down at the piano, and we just started working on the songs and instantaneously seemed to know exactly the direction I wanted to take it. And I felt that there was a sensitivity to what I was trying to achieve. Creatively, I think it was a great partnership.
Here's the track, Nothing But the Wheel, from Sleepless, the second CD Peter Wolf and Kenny White worked on.
Leaving all I know back home, rushing through the cold night air. Holding on to nothing but the wheel.
That's Nothing But the Wheel from Peter Wolf's CD Sleepless, produced by Kenny White. Well, now after years of producing and playing on other musicians' CDs, Kenny White is stepping out front with his own. It's called Symphony in 16 Bars.
You can have them hold your mouth. You can turn the ringer off. Pull the sheets over your head. Later you'll stop shooting yourself and shoot the moon instead.
That's Shoot the Moon by Kenny White from his new CD, Symphony in 16 Bars, and Kenny joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the sideman like being a frontman?
Well, the sideman took a few years to figure it out, but I'm feeling very comfortable doing it
now.
Yeah,
and we should say these are your words, your thoughts, your music. Critics are saying, well, one wrote this is the hidden gem of the year. You've performed before people in the industry who've just been blown away by what they're calling... adult music, finally.
Has a bad connotation in some places.
Well, actually, I want to ask you about that because you've been quoted as saying, well, it's kind of late in life for me, so I don't expect to get a huge following. How old are you?
I'm 51.
And so,
the reason I say it's late in life for me, it's only because of the demographics and the business I've chosen to be in, and those demographics are getting more and more important and prevalent.
Well, and as you know, you said, it takes a long time to build up a following. And
you know, 51 is the new 25.
So. Yeah, I was just going to say, you could do it. Well, I want to listen to a little more. Your voice has been compared to Elvis Costello, Tom Waits, some say maybe a little Randy Newman. What are you thinking of when you're, who influenced you?
All those people influenced me. I don't think I sound at all like Tom Waits, nor do I think anybody does, but I always liked Paul Simon as a craftsman. Van Morrison, you know, is a great artist. Always tried to do something different on each record. I love and will support anybody that will take a shot and just try something, you know, not make the same record twice.
Well, let's listen to your cut from the new CD, Symphony in 16 Bars. Here's Working on a Way.
I'm working on a way to get us out of here. They'll all show up one day. We'll be gone, shifting gears. You can't get nothing here but old. We're gonna turn rust into gold. And it might seem like we're doomed to stay, but I'm working on a way.
That's Working on a Way from Kenny White's new CD, Symphony in 16 Bars. We were talking about the different artists that you've produced. Peter Wolf, for instance, J. Geils, former J. Geils frontman, who is so specific about music. I mean, he's such a blues aficionado, and he's... What's that like working with him?
Wonderful. Blues aficionado, country aficionado. He loves old, you know, he just likes anything that's genuine, as do I. And I think we clicked because of a lot of our mutual feeling about music and what it should be, what it's always meant to us.
What exactly does a producer do? Like, what do you do with him?
Some artists are less hands-on than others. Some are more. Peter likes to be involved, and
right.
Obviously so. But a producer will help choose the musicians and the arrangements. For instance, that song on Sleepless, Nothing But the Wheel, was a song Peter had heard on a Patti Loveless record, a beautiful ballad. And he's great at this. He heard that and realized it could be just done an entirely different way. And as soon as he said that, I heard it too, and mm-hmm. We both picked up guitars, and we had the arrangement pretty much mapped out in his living room in 5 minutes. Then we had to execute it.
Right. And hire all the people. That's the song that we heard earlier as we began talking to you. Did you work on Mark Cohn's Walking in Memphis?
Walking in Memphis.
Not in a production capacity, but I was called in to do some arranging, and I did some vocals on it, some background vocals. I played some keyboards and percussion on it. He's a great friend of mine, too, and a great artist.
So you've worked with Peter and Mark Cohn and other artists. What did you bring from that into your own CD? I mean, if you have to help other people make their sound, what is your sound?
Well, I think it's, in some respects, it's a lot easier for me to be objective in the studio when it's other people's music I'm dealing with. You know, it's kind of like asking about love advice. I can disperse it at will and sometimes very eloquently, but I can't really follow it myself. So I ran into some of those problems when I started recording my own music, and especially my own vocals, because I've always been very sensitive about that. I don't think I was born with a gift like some people. You need some objective opinions when you're producing yourself, and I actually brought some people in to help me do my own stuff.
Well, I want to hear some more. The Cut Five Girls. What's the story behind that?
Five Girls started out with me at in another bar, although I was eating breakfast. It was a morning bar. It started out very literally. I was watching the women at the bar leaning over, and they all seemed to have the same tattoo. You know, it just struck me how the more we try to be different these days, the more we are the same. And the song just evolved where I think it became about taking risks in life.
Five girls leaning on the bar tonight. Five tattoos at the small of their back. Since when has our skin become a canvas? I won't ask the one with the cellophane backpack. Yeah, and I think that I might tell her that she's looking like a billboard with that shirt that's cute, but oh so inappropriate for the season. Instead, I drag my hand across the bar and grab my keys and walk away. Ah, but you can't be crucified for the things that you don't say.
Five Girls from Kenny White's new CD, Symphony in 16 Bars. I'm just getting this. Symphony in 16 Bars. Duh.
No, that actually, a lot of people think that, and it's great because a lot of these songs were written in bars. But no, the song, there's a song on the record called Symphony in 16 Bars, and that's exclusively what the title came from.
Okay, not while in 16 bars.
No,
okay.
No.
So what do you plan to do now, Kenny White? I mean, what if you are surprised and suddenly, even at 50 whatever, you get a big following?
I'm all for it. I'll just keep doing it until I can't do it anymore.
And besides, the Rolling Stones are still touring.
God bless them.
Singer-songwriter Kenny White. For more information on his new CD, Symphony in 16 Bars, and for his summer tour, check out our website, here-now.org.
They say the light from a star can travel for centuries. How come your smile fades before it ever reaches me? Tell me if there's something you need to say, or if you think everything's okay, but things just feel a little different today.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Ooh, I don't expect you to laugh at every word I say. If everything was black and white, God wouldn't have made gray. Things just feel a little different today.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.